You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Welcome to Full Power Living, the only show on international media that's dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your creator and host, and during this live broadcast, we invite you to interact with us on our chat here on the EmotionalPro.com radio page, or to call us toll-free at 800-630-7858, and you can ask your questions directly of our guests. You know, many years ago, the Beatles went to India, and they studied for a time with the Maharishi. And for many Americans, that's when we became aware that there were people who spent their lives in contemplation and meditation. And the Beatles proclaimed it to be miraculous. Most other people were talking about the mind-expanding abilities of LSD and marijuana, but notably the Beatles and Richard Alpert, who later became known as Ram Dass, were saying the mind could be expanded through contemplation and meditation. Well, whoever had the correct information, it was clear we were all interested in expanding our experiences through doing new things with our brains. And in the ensuing 50 years, scientists have conducted research to find out just how mind expansion occurs. What area of our brain gets activated when we're angry or scared or peaceful? How much ability do we have to change what goes on in our brains? And where exactly is the seat of thought? All of these questions have been explored and scientifically mapped during this time. So it's only right now that someone comes along who puts these together. Modern brain research joined with what we know from contemplative traditions such as Buddhism. And that's what our guest today, psychologist Rick Hansen, and his colleague, neurologist Richard Mindius, MD, have done in their recently released book, Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. Rick Hansen, PhD, is a neuropsychologist and meditation teacher. He's a summa cum laude graduate of the University of California in Los Angeles, and he co-founded the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. He also edits the Wise Brain Bulletin, which you can find at www.wisebrain.com. You can find him on the web also at rickhansen.net. And he and his wife have two children. And Rick Hansen, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you very much.
I found your book fascinating in that it explained a lot of the things scientifically that I have explored on a spiritual type basis over the years. I'm sure that's part of your interest too. Mm-hmm. But I like what you say in the foreword. You say that Buddha's brain is an invitation to use the focus of your mind to harness the power of attention to enhance your life and your relationships with others. It's a very gentle approach, and I want to start out by asking you, how is it that harnessing the power of attention through focus can enhance our lives?
Well, the basic idea is that mental activity changes brain structure. And when you first hear that, it sounds mind-boggling, but then you realize, well, wait a second, it had to have been that way all along. In other words, if you remember what you had for breakfast, or, you know, if you pull up a childhood memory, or you think back to when, you know, you learned your multiplication tables, the mental activities involved in those things, either living through the experience or deliberately trying to memorize something like the multiplication tables, you know, what's 4 times 5, had to produce some kind of enduring change inside the black box of the brain, you know, inside the 3 pounds of tofu, if you will, between the ears. And the point, though, is that no one really knew how that happened. And in the last 20 years, when brain science has literally roughly doubled in terms of what it actually knows, it's become increasingly clear exactly how immaterial mental activity, our thoughts, our feelings, and our unconscious processes actually produce enduring changes in our brain. In the famous saying of neuroscientists, neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, if you get a lot of mental activity, you get a lot of neural activity, and a lot of neural activity leads to changes in neural structure, for better or worse. The problem has been historically that a lot of it's been for worse. In other words, for example, if we, you know, ruminate over, dwell on our grievances, our resentments with other people, or, you know, what we don't like about life and so forth, we're getting a lot of neurons firing together. And guess what? We're going to get a lot of neurons wiring together in terms of the underlying neural structures of resentment or grievance or loss or wounding. Alternately, if we put our attention on, and this is, gets back to your specific question, if we put our attention on the good facts in our life, for example, as one way to build good neural structure, if we put our attention on the good facts of our life and then really kind of let those good facts become good experiences and stay with those good experiences 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, we're going to get a lot of neurons firing together in positive ways, which will then lead to positive neural structure.
You know, our sign-off on this program is pay attention to what you want to become and not to what you want to overcome. And that explanation that you gave is precisely why that works. And the good part is that I was thinking as you were talking that my early life was quite challenging, and I did think, I did wire together a lot of negative things, but the fantastic and wonderful thing is that all you have to do is start wiring together some positive ones and do that over time, and you can move past those early many years of doing things like that.
Exactly right. Exactly right. It's a little bit like building a muscle. You know, we understand that we've got to go to the gym, and we understand that if we, you know, lift 5 pounds once, we're going to get a little benefit. If we lift 5 pounds, you know, 10, 20 times a day, every day for 30 days in a row, we're going to get a pretty good benefit. And if we lift 5 pounds for a while and then 10 and 20, we're going to get a lot of benefit. The same is true with the brain. You know, use it or lose it. You and I are both therapists, and I don't know about you, but one thing that's happened for me is being a therapist a long time has made me both more compassionate, but it's also made me tougher-minded. It's made me really appreciate that you got to do the work. It's very old-fashioned. You got to earn it. But that's on the other hand, that's incredibly good news. It's so optimistic. The idea is that with a little skillfulness, which is what I tried to get at in my book, Buddha's Brain, you know, with some understanding of how the brain works and with some skillful use of the tools, you know, laid out in my book, and I'm not the only person writing about this sort of thing, you know, that a person can actually, in the trenches of daily life, in the middle of a commute, in the middle of a squabble with their kids or their partner or their coworker, in the middle of some upsetting mental reaction arising in their mind, in the middle of all that, they can actually do skillful things that will gradually lead to enduring changes in their own brain, which will then foster what we care about, which is more happiness, more love, and more wisdom.
Wow. I laughed because I have, as I've gotten older and done more and more therapy, I'm getting close to 40 years now, I refer to myself as a butt kicker. It's exactly
you
what
go.
You're talking about,
right?
Right. Now, yeah. I was very interested in what you wrote about relationships, because you say our relationships with one another are not a causal part of our lives. They are fundamental to how our minds function and the essential an essential aspect of brain health, because our social connections with one another shape our neural connections that form the structure of the brain, and that leads to the notion that the way we communicate alters the very circuitry of the brain. Can you expand on this a little bit? What do you mean by all of that?
Right. It's a really important point, and it's important to contextualize it. So I'll try to speak to both here. On the one hand, humans are the most profoundly social animal on the planet. And arguably, it was actually love, broadly defined, that drove the evolution of the brain over the last 100 million years. Kind of to do this quickly here, for example, if you compare, you know, birds and mammals to reptiles and fish, they both have roughly equivalent, you know, demands, and they've got to solve problems. But birds and mammals have bigger brains per body weight. What's the thing that birds and mammals do that fish and reptiles don't? Birds and mammals pair bond and then raise their young. And to do that, you got to be smarter. You know what I mean? Whether you're a sparrow or a squirrel, you got to pick the right person, the right partner. You got to work it out with them. Who's going to go get the nuts? Who's going to stay home and take care of the babies? You know, you got to have a bigger brain. and then jump to primates, you know, monkeys, baboons, chimps, and humans, very social animals living in small groups with each other, bands of, you know, 10 to 100, let's say, working stuff out, you know, who's on top, who's on the bottom, who's your friend, who's not. Again, you need a bigger brain. There's a direct correlation between the size of a primate group and the size of the brain in proportion to body weight. And then the third main step happened with humans. You know, we've been making tools for about 2.5 million years, our close ancestors, but the first tool makers, you know, had brains a third our size. And much of the tripling of the brain in the last 2.5-3 million years has been related to relationship capacity, social skills, language, cooperative planning, empathy, you know, alliances, you know, working stuff out with other people and all the rest of that, facial expressions that communicate social signals, and so forth. So in a way, love, not hate, not war, has driven the evolution of the brain. So we're very social. And so when we interact with each other, we actually change the brains of other people. You know, we induct other people into emotional states, or when we're with other people ourselves, we have these three main dedicated circuits that enable us to be empathic with them. In other words, enable us to simulate, in a sense, what it's like to be another person. And the three circuits are we simulate actions, one. Two, we simulate the emotions of other people. Other parts of the brain do that. And third, we simulate the state of mind, the thoughts, the dynamics, you know, the hopes and dreams, if you will, of the other person. That's the good news, all right? And so that is how, for example, a child, a very young child, is having her brain, in effect, sculpted over time by interactions with her parents or other peers. Or as an adult, we are in interaction with other people, and the way they treat us, you know, and the way we treat them, you know, is shaping our brains. The context here, though, it's important to appreciate that, you know, this is a very popular idea these days, the social brain hypothesis, it's actually called. And I think it's like a lot of fads, if you will, that move through the field of psychology. And it's, you know, if you look back on the history of psychology just the last 100 years, you know, psychoanalysis, behaviorism, you know, humanistic psychology, the cognitive revolution, now positive psychology, family therapy, right? Narrative therapy. Now it's the brain, and now it's the social brain hypothesis. You know, it's, you know, after a while, you these fads come and they go, and they're important. They're waves and so forth. But, you know, when the dust settles, you realize, okay, that's an important thing, but it's not the only thing. The same with this whole idea of relationships. First, people vary in the degree that they're relational. Some people are quite introverted. Other people are very relational and extroverted. Second, much of the development of the brain is driven by a person's interactions with the object world. In other words, material objects, you know, getting the spoon in the mouth instead of the ear, right? Or, you know, learning how to use one's own body to stand up and walk, or to be able to make things happen in one's world that are just independent of relationships. Going through school and learning to figure things out or not, you know, ranging from having, you know, let's say an issue with reading at one end, to at the other end, you know, being able to discover that one has a great gift at art and design. You know, all those are activities that have usually very little to do with relationships, and yet they themselves also sculpt the brain. So the way I would just kind of bottom line it is to really appreciate these amazing capacities we have for love and skillfulness in our relationships, but to also realize that we have to use them well. In other words, for all the dedicated circuits of empathy inside the human brain, look out in the world. You know, there's an awful lot of mistreatment of other people and failures of empathy. I mean, if we are so naturally empathic, why do therapists like you and me have to work so hard to help couples understand each other?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been very interested in empathy. I was going to ask you about it later, but now that it's up, let's talk about it. Yeah. Because there's so much inhumanity, you know, in our news, for example, we read about people raping one another, imprisoning one another, hurting one another. And my reaction is, you can't do that if you have empathy with the other person. And so we seem not to be developing empathy these days.
Right. Although,
do you see it that way?
I think it's complex, you know, when you're trying to think about things in an historical sense. I mean, I was just having a discussion with our daughter who's in college right now about the book of Genesis. And if you just kind of separate out the religious aspects of it, and just think of it as a as an account of the way people lived, you know, 3, 4, 5,000 years ago. It was really pretty intense. I mean, we were just talking about a story there where, you know, where a sister was raped, and the person who did it then said, "Boy, I'd really like to marry her." Her brother said, "Well, you can marry her if, you know, if you do this thing, and all your relatives do this thing, which was to get circumcised as adults, all right?" And then 3 days later, quote, while they were still hurting, the brothers of the woman, a young woman, basically killed the man who did the rape, and they also killed all his relatives, all right?
Uh-huh.
Not a lot of empathy there. And so it's, you know, and that's just a small story, obviously, from one tradition or time and place, and you know there are many equivalent stories in other traditions in the world. So, you know, I think it's you know it's complex to think about you know empathy and historically. The other side of it though is I do worry about the way in which in the modern culture, particularly in America, that with the intense immersion we have in very intrusive media and all kinds of other information coming at us, you know, in a fire hose, it tends to make people bunker up. And then when they do that, the circle of us starts to really shrink. And the wider sense of them out there grows. And we evolved to be very cooperatively altruistic and loving toward us, yet fearfully aggressive toward, quote-unquote, them. There's a lot of science these days about how the you know early bands of humans and our ancestors evolved, you know, cooperating and having wonderful teamwork within the band, within which they mainly bred and passed on their genes, while at the same time being very aggressive and competitive and violent with and exploitive with other bands with whom they also competed. So, you know, those genes are in us today, the genes for cooperation with us but fearful aggression toward them. And, you know, in the Native American saying, which I talk about in the book, we've got two wolves in our heart, one of love and one of hate. And then what I get into in the book is a lot about, okay, how do you feed the wolf of love, right? And how do you starve and restrain the wolf of hate? And I think that's, you know, as I think you're getting at, that's critically important in the world today. I mean, it's critically important in a family, in a marriage, in the workplace, in a neighborhood, but it's also critically important in the wider world when, you know, we've got caveman brains armed with nuclear weapons in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And when we look out at the world and we see a whole lot of thems out there, we need to start expanding the notion of us to include everybody in the world. Yes, there are issues we've got to work out and all the rest of that, but, you know, the kind of automaticity in the caveman brain of regarding them as not human, right, and as either threats or you know, resources to be exploited, that tendency in the caveman brain is, you know, pushing the world to the brink, and we really need to get a grip on it.
And what you're showing in Buddha's brain is a way of helping us to get there. We're up to our first break, and I want to talk in the next segment with you about emotions and the brain. And you're listening to Full Power Living, where we're discussing Buddha's brain, the practical neuroscience of happiness, love, and wisdom with psychologist Rick Hansen. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
How difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want? To take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes? Or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them? Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So, if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles that you can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com. We're back on Full Power Living, talking today with neuropsychologist Dr. Rick Hansen, who's sharing the fascinating notion that we can use our brain to expand our mind and improve our lives, or use our mind to expand our brain. Which is it, Rick?
It's really both together. If you lose your big toe, it's not good, but okay. But if you lose a piece of your brain, it's potentially catastrophic. And the brain really is, I mean, obviously the brain is the headquarters of the nervous system, so we're really talking here about the nervous system altogether, but boy, the brain is ground zero for our hopes, our dreams, our pains, our pleasures, whether we suffer and cause harm or whether we're happy and loving. That's it. And these days, certainly I guess throughout history, but I think it's a very common experience or feeling these days to feel kind of pushed around by life. All kinds of big events happen, you know, the economy, Al-Qaeda, politics, Fox News, whatever, you know, and global warming, layoffs, jobs, outsourcing, you know, everything and all, you know, et cetera. Plus, there are emotional reactions to these situations. So it's very common to have a sense of feeling buffeted by life. What's great is to get a sense increasingly, on the other hand, that you can put your hands on the steering wheel yourself and guide your brain and guide your emotional reactions as a result increasingly in a positive direction.
Well, you know, that's fascinating to me. You and I have known each other at least 15 years, known of each other and worked together a little bit. And what you don't know about me is that in the last 15 years, I've married a neurosurgeon.
Ah.
And I also, my former husband's son was severely brain injured in a bicycle automobile collision also. So I've had some experiences where I certainly have learned, I've actually observed brain surgery right up close, and I really see what can happen to the brain. Now, here's the interesting thing. I'm married to a man who works with the brain, who understands how it works, but he worries. And one of the things that I have worked on between him and me is the whole issue of worry, because he's wired together the worry direction, and I have refused to do that, and I take action instead. Now, I want to say that over the last 11 years, this has changed a lot, and he's worrying a lot less. But it's interesting to me that we may know a lot about the brain and how it works mechanically, but we still may not be able to deal with our own wiring.
That's right.
How do we make that better?
You got to do the work. In other words, just like
oh, dear.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you may know the story. How many therapists does it take to change a light bulb?
Only one, but you have to be willing.
The light bulb has to want to change.
And, oh, there you go.
There you go. It's stupid but profound. And so, you know, people, the good news is that, for example, take worry. You know, let's say worry is the result of several different factors. One, let's say it's based on a kind of scanning that's automatic for threats, that's maybe based on temperament. And then second, maybe it's also based on a tendency to kind of evaluate threats as worse than they really are. And then also, let's say there's a kind of a fast track of fear in the emotional circuitry of the brain. Well, the good news is that with repeated mental activity, in other words, by doing a few little things, but several times a day, a person can actually change that. For example, a person can start scanning more deliberately for resources, both out there in the world and inside themselves, and start to defeat what scientists call the negativity bias of the brain, which routinely tends to focus more on threats than on opportunities. In other words, it looks for sticks rather than carrots, because in evolution, Sticks were much more consequential usually. In other words, if you missed a carrot today, you'd usually have a chance at another one tomorrow. But if you missed a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. And so the brain literally, it does, it is, as I say, it is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. That's the default setting. We can override that default setting with mindful, conscious, deliberate, willed attentiveness to positive information that's factual. I don't mean ignoring genuine threats. I mean, doing what one must with genuine threats. But I also mean really looking for good news, both inside oneself and out there in the world. And as one does that routinely, what will increasingly happen is that the scanning settings, if you will, you know, the kind of priming or default nature of what we look for will gradually shift over time. What will also gradually shift over time is the growing internalization of the emotional response to the good news that we begin to recognize. Any single time we recognize good news and we feel it, that's the important point. We have to feel it and we have to stay with the feeling of it for 10, 20, 30 seconds to get those neurons firing together, for example. But any single time we do that won't make a huge difference in neural structure. But if we routinely do it, even men and even neurosurgeons can do this and over time actually produce changes in what's called implicit memory or the limbic system, the emotional system of their own brain. I'm incredibly hopeful now for what can actually be done with the changing the brain from the inside out through the mind alone. I mean, for thousands of years, probably hundreds of thousands of years, people have known that if they did certain things with their mind, it led to certain changes in their mind, right? But they never knew exactly how it worked. It's a little bit like, being given a computer with no pull-down menus, no instruction manual, and you just kind of have to figure it out. And you start to learn over time that if you push the keys like this, you get a certain result on the screen. But what's increasingly available now through the meeting that's historically unprecedented of modern science of psychology and neurology combined with the ancient contemplative traditions of mental training, you know, in all the world's traditions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and Buddhism, the tradition that I know best and has probably had the greatest intersection with Western science, through the intersection that's historically unprecedented of these great traditions, we're actually getting an operating manual for how the darn computer works, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And we're starting to learn, oh yeah, you just hit this key at the same time you hit that other key, kazamo, you can get some really cool stuff happening on the screen. In other words, by intervening inside the brain, inside that black box, with greater clarity and dexterity and understanding, you can actually produce really lasting changes inside your own brain, which then lead to wonderful results in terms of your feelings and your thoughts and your relationships.
I'm really aware as you make that description. Through my son, I got a Macintosh computer a few months back, and I was at first feeling intimidated by it, and then I kept saying to myself, Eileen, even children can do this. And so just take the risk, just experiment, just follow your intuition. And it strikes me that that's the same thing we need to do with our brain. We need to take the risk and move on out and get really excited about exploring them.
That's exactly right.
Well, now, you, in Buddhist brain, you are putting the ancient contemplative practices, for example, the three pillars of Buddhist practice of virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom, and you're sort of correlating those with the three functions of the brain, which is regulation, learning, and selection. And I think we could probably talk all day on this one thing, but how do the pillars get supported by the brain, and why is this important to Plumber Joe or Secretary Jane?
Sure. Well, we all want to be happy, right? And even if a person is kind of invested in being morose, well, you could say that's their way of being happy. So we all want to be happy. We all want, I think, deep down, to make some sense of our lives. The question, of course, is how to do that. So you've had people throughout the ages who've really studied that question, just like some people have really studied, you know, how to make glass or how to make gold rings or, you know, how to heal measles or something like that. you've had similar people who have figured out, who really studied, how to have deep contentment that's unconditional. And no matter what's happening out in the world, that there's a fundamental kind of well-being that persists. And also people who studied how to be skillful with others, right, in terms of working mm-hmm. things out with them. So what have these people found? And what's interesting is that across all kinds of traditions, both spiritual traditions and more modern, let's say, purely psychological ones, the same three themes keep surfacing. And often the same words are even used. It's interesting that when I was writing the book, I have a friend who is a Christian minister, who's a professor of theology, and I was talking with him about virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom in the Buddhist contemplative tradition, and he said, wow, you know, pretty much exactly the same words are used in some of the Christian contemplative traditions, you know, that obviously developed in a completely different framework and culture. So, you know, and then you see much the same themes showing up, for example, in positive psychology today. In other words, it's the idea that, you know, what are the fundamental keys to happiness? One, we've got to have good character. There's really no substitute for good character. There's no bypass here. We have to develop virtue, broadly defined. That doesn't mean being moralistic, but it means being able to be patient, to have grit, to be determined, to be tenacious, to be forgiving, to be generous, to be able to restrain, you know, our kind of reflexive reptile brain, inner, you know, monkey brain reactions to other people. That's virtue. We have to not harm ourselves and others. That's virtue. Second, we really need to be able to control where we put our attention. Attention is this combination of spotlight, it illuminates what it rests upon, and vacuum cleaner, because whatever we pay attention to preferentially activates the neural networks of that which we're paying attention to. So in effect, what we pay attention to gets sucked into our brain and therefore woven into the fabric of our being. So we need to be able to control where we put attention, and we need to be aware, right? We need to be aware of ourselves. We need to be aware of our what's arising in our own mind, and we need to be aware of the consequences, for better or worse, of our actions, right? That's mindfulness mm-hmm. right there, which can be refined, particularly in the spiritual traditions, to a very, very powerful laser-like microscope that can peer very, very deeply into what's actually happening moment to moment, both in the mind and in the world. And the third thing that we have to be able to do is we've got to be able to make good choices. I love the Dr. Phil question. How's that working for you? You know, for better or worse, is it harming or helping? What, or as the Buddha might say, or other people might say, you know, I think Jesus it was who said, ye shall know a tree by its fruits. In other words, mm-hmm. what are the fruits? What are the results? What are the consequences? And therefore, to be happy, we need to progressively make better and better choices. We need to select. In other words, one way to describe wisdom fundamentally is that it's a matter of giving up lesser pleasures and rewards for greater and more profound ones. So there you have it. Virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom across many traditions and woven into also modern psychology. So what's interesting, though, is that these insights into the causes that lead to happiness that are expressed in purely psychological or sometimes spiritual terms, in other words, fundamentally purely mental terms, it's no accident that they've arisen because they map very closely to the three fundamental activities or functions of the nervous system. In other words, whether you're a Christian contemplative in the deserts of Jordan or a Buddhist contemplative, you know, in the jungle of Sri Lanka, or a shaman in the Amazonian rainforest, or, you know, whatever, a Sufi master living in Egypt, whatever it is, you're still dealing with a human brain. You know, the differences in DNA amongst the members of humanity are tiny, minuscule differences. We're fundamentally dealing with the same brain. So it's no accident that what works in the mind across all cultures boils down to these three fundamental functions of the human nervous system, which, of course, are the same across all cultures. Namely, as you said at the beginning here, regulation, learning, and selection. In other words, regulation is a lot like virtue. Learning is very much linked to mindfulness and attention. And selection is at the essence of wisdom. So, you know, the bottom line here, in a fundamental sense, is if a person wants to get better at mindfulness, you know, virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom, they need to get better, in effect, at regulation, learning, and selection. And then in my book, I laid out, you know, a pathway to doing that that people can do in the middle of the trenches, you know, in the middle of the commute, in the middle of their busy lives, how they can actually do that in real time.
Yes, that's very, very helpful. Now, this fascinated me. You say it's a general moral principle that the more power you have over someone, the greater your duty is to use that power benevolently. And then you go on to point out that the person over whom we have the greatest power is our own future self.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this take us?
I think it takes us to a sense of care and concern for ourselves and compassion for ourselves. And a sense of, you know, to kind of use an old-fashioned word, stewardship. I mean, we are the stewards of our lives. Our, in effect, this whole life, this precious human life, you know, it's like the poet Mary Oliver puts it, you know, what shall you do with your one wild and precious life? What will we make of it? It was handed to us on the day we were born. And, you know, this personality, for sure, gets only one life. And maybe there's only one life, period. What will we make of it? And so, you know, that's what I think is the takeaway point, which I, you know, I write about, the importance of self-compassion and the importance of getting on your own side. What's interesting, of course, is that that's actually hard for a lot of us to do, to be actually compassionate and kind toward ourselves and to be for ourselves, not against others, but to be for ourselves so that our own suffering matters to us, and our own potential, and the realization of our own potential matters to us. So, you know, what's interesting, of course, is how to actually do that, and I've given some thought to, you know, the brain states that underlie self-compassion and the brain states that underlie being on one's own side, and given some thought to how to actually stimulate those brain states so that one is naturally inclining increasingly toward self-compassion and naturally inclining increasingly toward being on one's own side.
And I think what a lot of us don't understand, too, is, and it can be a motivator, is that the more we are compassionate with ourselves, the more we can be compassionate with others.
That's exactly right. Yeah, totally true. It's, you know, a lot of studies have shown that the more that people, as a generalization, but the more that people feel content themselves, fulfill themselves, that they've got resources themselves, they're not in pain, you know, they're happy and all right, the more generous they tend to be toward others. There's this great quote from the philosopher and mathematician Bertrand Russell, who said, to paraphrase, that the good life, is, as I conceive it, is a happy one. Not that good people are happy, but that happy people are good people. In other words, that the more we're inclined to be, the happier we are, as a generalization, the more inclined we are to be good to other people.
I'm fascinated. You don't talk about this specifically in your book, but the concept of responsibility, I have learned that responsibility is one of the building blocks of our self-esteem, and a happy person who is being compassionate toward themselves and others is a person who's taking responsibility for what he or she is thinking, the actions they're taking, and so forth.
Right. I think that I would put that under the heading of virtue.
Okay.
You know, we take responsibility, we admit our faults, we clean up our messes, and we look out at the world and we say, you know, if I want to make something happen in my life, I've got to take up arms against my oppressors. And frankly, most of the oppressors in our life live between our own ears.
Yeah, they are us, huh?
Yeah, you know the old line, you know, sleeping with the enemy. Well, every night we go to bed with the enemy, which is to say our own reactive tendencies and, you know, the voices inside our own head that are very self-critical. They're brutally shaming and self-critical for many of us. Very unfair. Critics and judges are yammering away inside our own head, you know, like the press secretary for some jerk of a dictator somewhere, or pick your least favorite politician. Those voices are yammering away inside our own head. So for me, you know, responsibility means being a hammer instead of a nail. Yes, there are many, many things we cannot do anything about, and they generally are out there in the world. But the things that we can do something about, let's do what we can. You know, I think of this, I guess I'm doing a lot of quotes in this interview, but I think about this boy who was born with AIDS, with HIV in South Africa. You know, HIV, as you know, is very prevalent there, and a lot of children are born with it completely innocently. You know, they didn't do anything to get AIDS. And he died, actually, when he was probably, I think, around 12 or 13. But along the way, he became a spokesman for AIDS in general, and in particular children in South Africa and in Africa in general who were infected with AIDS at birth, and or before they were born, actually. And so the point I'm making is that his quote was essentially, you know, do what you can in the place where you are with what you've been given in the time that you have. And
wow.
I have that quote on my wall, and I look at it, you know, and it's very humbling. I mean, if he could say that, this little kid, basically, 10, 12 years old, when he said that, you know, what are we to do? We need to do what we can.
That's a great place for us to take our second break. That's a powerful, powerful quote. You're listening to Full Power Living. I'm your host, Eileen Dillon. Stay tuned for more with our guest today, Dr. Rick Hansen, author of Buddha's Brain. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Everybody feels anger. But if you don't learn to deal with it, anger can mess up your life. It can cause you relationship problems, difficulties on the job, or create health problems. If you want a way to understand and work with anger that's simple yet so powerful, it helps you to put an end to the specific angers that are messing up your life, then you'll want to get a copy of a mini course I've created for you entitled Reduce Anger Now. With it, I want you to be able to figure out what's stimulating the anger you feel and have an easy way to change that anger so you can dramatically reduce the anger in your life. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, longtime psychotherapist, coach, and anger expert. I've helped thousands of people to master anger, and I want you to begin to become an anger master in your life. Order Reduce Anger Now at the store, www.emotionalpro.com. That's www.emotionalpro.com. All right, welcome back to Full Power Living. You know, we're getting popular with authors and thinkers. I just realized yesterday, we've been on the air 6.5 years now, and a lot of people who are interested in reaching a thinking and caring audience like you, who also want to go more deeply into their topic, are making contact, and that means we've got some great guests scheduled for you. Look on the radio show page of emotionalpro.com to see the list through April. Here are a few that you will recognize. Next week, I'm talking with Ariane de Bonvoisin. I think I'm going to have to practice that. She's author of The First 30 Days, and she'll be following up on this discussion with Dr. Rick Hansen, sharing ways to go through change more easily. And the following week, Chopra Center Medical Director David Simon will be discussing healing, and especially with a focus on emotional healing. And in March, we have Marcy Shymoff, who's co-author of several Chicken Soup for the Soul books, and she's going to be talking with us about Happy for No Reason. And following her, we have actress Marielle Hemingway. She's going to be talking with us about our physical health as we explore Marielle's kitchen. So download our shows to your MP3 player or your computer, and you can go to iTunes and subscribe under my name, Eileen, I-L-E-N-E, Dillon, Eileen Dillon. We've got nearly 300 shows archived right here at Emotional Pro for you. Just tell your friends and family, keep listening, keep supporting us in our quest to awaken the world to the power and importance of human emotions. Our guest today is Dr. Rick Hansen, author of Buddha's Brain, and you can find out more about him. He's got two websites where you can find out quite a bit about him, and they're very peaceful and lovely to visit. One is called rickhansen.net. That's RICKHANSON.net. And the other is wisebrain.org. So, how fascinating. Where was I here? Oh, it's about suffering.
Too many good things.
Well, I didn't want to look at this, I'm sure, because I wanted to talk about suffering.
All right.
Because we tend to suffer. We make ourselves suffer, and you have a whole chapter on how it is that we suffer. And can you tell us in a thimbleful?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of – that's the bummer chapter, right? So I feel like, you know, it's kind of common sense. You know, you have to define the problem before you can solve it, right? I used to be a business consultant before I became a, you know, a soft-headed and soft-hearted therapist, as it were. And, you know, one thing you realize is that you got to know what you're dealing with before you can really, really address it. So, you know, I get very interested in the question of why do we suffer? And first of all, I want to define that word. By suffering, obviously that includes, you know, agonizing experiences, but mostly I'm talking here about, you know, feeling dissatisfied, frazzled, irritated, anxious, worried, guilty, uneasy, you know, the daily stuff, basically, of discontent and dis-ease and, you know, mild but kind of pervasive unhappiness. And so the question in here is that why in the world do human beings suffer in the way they do, particularly in ways that seem extreme compared to other members of the animal kingdom? I mean, we have a cat, and our cat, for example, doesn't like it when he's sick because he got bit by another cat. He doesn't like it when we put him in his little, you know, box and take him to the vet, you know, for medicine and so forth. But it's not a huge deal. You can see that as, you know, that he gets over it very quickly. He doesn't, like some people who shall be nameless, worry about things, you know, unnecessarily, right? Uh-huh. Whether it's my wife or your husband, let's say. And so the question is, why in the world do we do that? And what do we do about it? And that's where I think different traditions have an analysis of suffering, both its causes and therefore the causes of its ending, that can be very, very helpful. So I brought to bear the analysis from Buddhism, which is, as I said, it's a tradition I know well. In the book, I'm not pushing Buddhism. I'm just kind of using it in a clear-eyed way and as, you know, something as a deep, basically, psychology of the mind. So in the Buddhist analysis, there's this metaphor of the two darts. It's the idea that in life, there are inevitable first darts. Old age, disease, and death are great examples. Also, emotional pain. You know, if we lose a loved one, there's no way around it. We're going to feel some pain. We evolved to feel that. The problem, though, is that we usually add tons of second darts in terms of our mental reactions to the first darts, right? Something happens, and we get our knickers in a twist about it. Or people who shall be nameless, nothing bad has happened, and they still have their knickers in a twist about it. Or even sometimes good things happen, and we get rattled by it. Like, for example, someone pays us a compliment, and we start feeling bad because we think, gosh, if they only knew what a schmuck I was. They would never say that sort of thing to me.
I don't do that anymore. That makes me feel way too
that's
bad.
Good. That's good. That's right. Anyway, so the point is, you know, we can't do anything. Yes, there's definitely a place for reducing the first darts in life to the extent that we can, for sure. But we have to recognize there's an irreducible minimum. No one gets out of this life without experiencing a lot of first darts. On the other hand, you know, we can do a lot about our second dart reactions to those first darts, and including to situations where no dart has landed at all. In other words, nothing bad has actually happened, but we're just getting caught up in some kind of mental reaction. And that's what I wrote about. In other words, if you understand how the brain, through evolution, is primed to throw second darts, because that's a good way to pass on gene copies. It's a lousy way to have quality of life. The brain is tilted toward, you know, passing on its genes. It's tilted against quality of life. Therefore, by tilting strongly toward quality of life in our own case, in other words, through self-compassion, through getting on our own side, through paying attention to the good and taking it in, through the kinds of stuff that you're talking about every week in wonderful ways, by getting on our own side in that way and through skillful ways that are brain savvy, which I wrote about in my book, then we can actually level the playing field, right? And as a result, suffer a lot less and cause a lot less suffering for other people.
Well, that's really, you did a great thimbleful there. That's wonderful. So we've been talking a lot about the problems, and I want to focus a little bit more on the solutions. And you talk about mindfulness and meditation. Could you tell us a little bit about how you see what meditation is, how you see what mindfulness is, and why they would help us to change this tilt?
Sure. Mindfulness may sound a little esoteric, but everybody's mindful in different ways. You know, for example, if you're, cooking a new dish, let's say, something you've never made before, you're paying particular attention to what you're doing. Or maybe you're in a situation with your boss at work and you're trying to kind of work up to asking him or her for a raise. You know, you're often very mindful of what's going down, you know, in the run-up to that request. So we know how to be mindful. The hard thing for most of us is to be mindful for more than a few seconds in a row. That's the trick, particularly when what we're mindful of is not amazingly stimulating. You know, as they say, nobody has ADHD in a video arcade, right? Because there's so much stimulation going on, it's completely compelling. The trick is, of course, to be mindful of something fairly neutral and repetitive, like the sensations of breathing, breath after breath after breath after breath. I guess I really am doing quotes today. William James, the father of American psychology, a famous line in which he said, "The education of attention would be an education par excellence," right? That's pretty cool, right? So by getting greater control of attention, which is to say mindfulness, in other words, greater control of the inner spotlight and vacuum cleaner, then you can control much more what goes inside your brain and therefore how you build brain structure. And then the question, of course, is how to do it. So what I tell people is make a promise to yourself that you're going to meditate a minute or more a day. You're just going to take 1 minute a day before you go to bed and in a formal way do something simple like just pay attention to the sensations of breathing for a few minutes. And as a result, you know, you will gradually actually get greater control of your attention. And as brain studies have shown, you will actually thicken the parts of the brain that are involved in controlling attention.
Uh-huh. Wow, you make it sound so delightful, and that's a very doable kind of thing too.
Well, it is doable, you know, and the idea, maybe I know we're moving to a wrap here, it's the idea that at a time when so many of us feel pushed around and like we don't have much control over worldly events or our reactions to them, it's fantastic to feel that you have increasing influence over your own brain and therefore over your own experience of living.
Yes. I've had so many experiences in the last few years about that, and we haven't had a lot of time to talk about equanimity, but that has been one of the things that really stands out. The definition I came up with equanimity is evenness of mind, especially under stress.
Yeah.
And this inner calm that we have is that you're describing with equanimity, regardless of what's going on, is just such a benefit. Mm. It's so wonderful, and this is what the techniques and the understanding that you have in Buddhist brain can lead people to develop in themselves, which I think is fabulous.
Yeah, that's totally true. And then the benefits ripple out and touch other people. I mean, interestingly, one of the most generous things a person can do is to work on their own mind and brain to become a happier, loving, and wiser person. Paradoxically, even as one becomes happier and has more well-being and more stability of well-being and so forth, one actually starts benefiting other people more and more.
Uh-huh. That's definitely true. And without a lot of effort. You do the work and the work begins to do itself.
Yeah, that's really true.
Now you can quote me too. Okay.
Thank you.
So let me remind you.
Eileen Dell said this amazing thing. You know, if you do the work, after a while, the work starts to do itself. That's right.
There you go. Thank you. Do write that down. I'll have to write it down too, so I'll remember I said it. So we do have to wrap here. And let me remind people that your book is entitled Buddha's Brain, and that they can also find out more about you and your work at rickhansen.net and wisebrain.org. Dr. Rick Hansen, I want to thank you for being my guest here on Full Power Living today, and thank you for sharing your cutting-edge involvement in this exciting new field of combining psychology and neurology and contemplative practice. I think it has a profound potential for helping us to transform ourselves and our world, so thank you for bringing it to our attention.
Oh, I appreciate you a lot as well, and I appreciate the chance to talk with you and hopefully, you know, benefit people that are listening.
Great. Thank you. I hope we can talk again.
Okay, great.
Be sure to join us every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific time when we continue our tradition on Full Power Living of bringing you the most cutting-edge thinkers and helpers on the planet, addressing the power of emotions in our lives. Next week, we host Ariane de Bonvoisin and her work with Change, discussing the first 30 days. We look forward to having you with us. And thanks to our supportive and talented producer at Fresh Talk Media, Paul Johnston. Until next time, I'm your host, Eileen Dillon, thanking you for listening and reminding you, pay attention to what you want to become, not to what you want to overcome.
Listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.